Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have a pre-Mr. Olympia interview with Dan Solomon. Dan is the president of the Mr. Olympia Productions, and this is his second year doing it. He's doing a great job. And we finally got a chance to sit down with Dan and do a little interview with him because, as you probably heard in the show last week, they just changed the location of the Mr. Olympia from Las Vegas, where it's been since 1999, and they were going to hold it at Planet Hollywood there this year, away from the Orleans Hotel, where it's been for many, many years. But they had to change it because of the COVID-19 restrictions. They would not have had a big audience. They would have been very, very limited at the audience in Vegas, so they went to Orlando, Florida instead. And they did this with only about a month left before the contest. Right now, the Mr. Olympia contest is about 3 weeks away. It'll be on December 17th through the 20th. So we finally got a chance to sit down with Dan and talk about the changes they've had to go through in order to move it to Orlando and what we can look forward to with this year's Mr. Olympia contest, which will be, I believe, the 56th annual Mr. Olympia. And congratulations to Dan and Jake Wood, who owns the Mr. Olympia, for being able to pull that off in order to have a Mr. Olympia, because looks like the other option would have been canceling, which nobody wanted to see. All right, before we get to that interview, I do want to talk about our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so what else is going on? We got some pretty good emails from our interview with Mario Nieves, which was our second part of our interview last week. So I'm going to read those in a second. And I want to mention the death of David Prowse. David Prowse was the original Darth Vader from the very first three Star Wars movies, the first trilogy in the 1970s. David was 85 years old. For those of you that know your bodybuilding history, he was also a weightlifting champion. Back in 1962, David won the British Weightlifting Championships, and he also won it in 63 and 64. So I looked on his Wikipedia page, and it says he was a bodybuilder, but I couldn't find any evidence of him competing in bodybuilding. But I do remember, I think, Bob Kennedy at Muscle Mag International years ago saying David was a bodybuilder. But he was a trainer for Christopher Reeves in the very first Superman movie back in 1978. So I did not know that. So he tried out for the role, and they didn't give it to him, but they told him he could train Christopher Reeve. But David Prowse was a big guy, 6'6". And that was not his voice as Darth Vader in the original Star Wars movies. That was the great actor James Earl Jones, who was also in Conan the Barbarian, of course. He was Thulsa Doom, the bad guy, in the original Conan the Barbarian. But James Earl Jones was a great theater actor, great movie actor, and he had a great commanding voice. So he had the voice for Darth Vader, but the body of Darth Vader was played by David Prowse. So rest in peace, David Prowse. He just died November 28th, just this last weekend at 85 years old. So just wanted to mention that. I finally put up another edition of Bodybuilding History on my YouTube channel. So if you follow my YouTube channel under my name, John Hansen, check it out under the Bodybuilding History playlist. This is about the 1968 Mr. Olympia. which Sergio Oliva won unopposed. This was his second Mr. Olympia contest. And also in that contest, Frank Zane won the Mr. America contest, and Chuck Sipes won the Mr. World contest. So we talk about that. It's getting some good views already. I just put it up yesterday, and already it's getting some good views. So a lot of people love those bodybuilding histories. So we got some comments already on that from YouTube, so I'm going to read those as well. And our interview with Dan is pretty short. It's only like 30 minutes. So at the end of his interview, I am going to treat you guys to a little bit of Muscle Wars, the great, great book by Rick Wayne. If you guys have not read this book, please look for it on eBay or Amazon. I'm not sure if it's on Amazon, but you might be able to find a copy on eBay. I think it was written in about 1985, somewhere around there. But Rick is a great writer. Probably, I think, in my opinion, the best writer ever in the field of bodybuilding. And he was also a great bodybuilder. And he competed way back in the 60s. And he's known Arnold Schwarzenegger since he was 19 years old. He saw and competed with Sergio Oliva at his prime. So that's what I'm going to read, a little section of the book about Sergio Oliva and the 1968 Mr. Olympia contest, since that was the event I just covered. So I'm going to read a few pages from the book. So if you guys want to stick around for that afterwards, I'm not sure if you guys like those little readings I do every once in a while. I haven't really got any feedback on it, but I'm sure some people out there like it. So I'm going to do that right after our interview with Dan Solomon. All right, let's get to some of our comments here about the Mario Neves interview part two. My Facebook page, Thomas Hintz, who was a guy I used to train with back at Hammer's Gym back in the day in the 80s. Tom said he was an inspiration for so many young bodybuilders. My good friend Dennis Durkin from Chicago said, what a great interview he was. Glenn Kinnear, 1986, Mr. World and Mr. America, said, awesome. Glenn looked up to Mario when he was growing up. Tiger Pulliam, another friend of mine from Chicago, said Mario was an awesome bodybuilder. Darrell Harmon said, pre-Haney days. James Lucas said, great interview, John, and an amazing career. And Larry Bernstein, another great bodybuilder from the 70s and 80s. He won his class at the Mr. America contest in 1983 when Jeff King won the overall. He said, that's great, John. Thanks. And on my YouTube channel, also got some comments here. This one says, I remember him from the cover of Muscle Training Illustrated magazine back in 1976. He still looks good. Yeah, Mario does look good. He looks very, very healthy for 72 years old. He looks, God, he looks 15, 20 years younger than that, in my opinion. Samuel Clemens said he was a very, very good bodybuilder, now a good role model and a good American. Angel Oliva said, another fantastic interview. Thanks, Mr. Hansen. Jay Main said, great interview. Do you think you could get Paul DeLette on at some point? Yeah, I would love to get Paul DeLette on. I just have to find a way to reach him. Luis Gomez said, wow, awesome part two interview. I always wondered about how Mario got into movies. Very class act. I like his positive attitude. I'm looking forward to more legends on your YouTube videos. I really like your old school bodybuilders. Keep it up. You're awesome. God bless you and stay safe during these difficult times. By the way, happy Thanksgiving to you and your family. Thank you. Glenn said, some great guests, John. Keep rolling them on. Soul Sergeant said, Mario also had a supplement line called Mar System Pro-Am. Philip said, thank you. Great stuff. Odessa File said, to me, Mario had an incredible balanced physique like Frank Zane, Joe Means, Richard Baldwin. Regarding Chuck Norris, I had the opportunity to meet him and the late Steve James and train in the Nautilus gym owned by Mimi Dreyfus at the Tel Aviv Hilton in 1985 when he filmed Delta Force. He was friendly, funny, and kind to me, and he allowed me to use his total gym, which he used in the gym. Chuck is really a nice guy. Hercules said, great interview. I wish you would stop saying tournament. We're not doing karate. It's a bodybuilding contest, not a tournament. And that's it. That's it for my comments. And also, like I said, I did that video about the 1968 Mr. Olympia contest. So we got some comments here. I'll read those real quick. Fitness Comedy said, when Weider saw Arnold, he made sure to help him in the battle versus Sergio for the video. Thank you for the video. Dean said, John Hansen is the man. I love listening to this man and his guest. Old school bodybuilding is the best. Cage said, I'm looking back at Sergio Oliva's book, Sergio Oliva, The Myth, His Life Story. He lists the reasons or excuses as to why his competitors didn't show up for the 68 Mr. Olympia. The mere fact that Oliva was so massive with no weak points probably intimidated his rivals into believing that they had no chance of beating him. Richard Lawson said, even now, Oliva's front double lat spread is number one. If I could pose Sergio in one pose, it would be in that pose. Nobody before or after could stand a chance. Amazing. Jojo said, your show is amazing as the best insights of bodybuilding history. Xavier said, this channel is the bomb. Keep it up. Oliver said, so cool. At 5 minutes and 35 seconds, I thought that the picture of Frank Zane was Milos Skarsev. David said, I did not know about the incident on stage at the 68 Olympia with Dan Lorry directly calling out Sergio in front of Weider. Fascinating. Sergio never talked about that when I spent time with him in Rogers Park, Chicago. I didn't think he mentioned it in his book that he wrote with Frank Bercianti either. The only time Sergio really came in ripped and conditioned during the 1970s was at the 1972 Olympia, where he really should have been declared the winner over Arnold, who wasn't as good as his 73, 74, or 75 winning conditions. Sergio sure was grainier in 68 too, even based on the black and white photos. Do you know what happened later with Sergio's gyms that he had? First, he had his power and beauty gym with his then wife, Arlene, in the warehouse building right across from Pottawatomie Park by the Metro train tracks, where I went to summer day camp as a kid in the early 1980s. And we'd see Sergio occasionally and in his police uniform. Then in 1990-91, Sergio owned or co-owned a powerhouse gym on Lincoln Avenue and McCormick Boulevard near Lincolnwood, Illinois, and it suddenly went out of business. I was told it was a bad business deal for Sergio, but I never asked him directly about it, even after having a membership there for a while. No, I don't know what happened with Sergio's gyms. I know he had that one that you were talking about. I didn't know that he owned that powerhouse, but I don't know what happened. The Iron Force said, amazing trivia with the controversy of Sergio and Dan Lorry and the Weider supplement clash on stage. Very cool breakdown here. Well done, John. Odessa File said, I was at World's Gym in Santa Monica on a day in January 1981, and somehow I was standing by the Roman chair bench. All of a sudden, Erwin Zabel Kwaszewski comes in out of nowhere and says to me, I'm using that. Joe H. said, I wish my name was Rock Stonewall. Sydney said, hello, good video. Philip said, incredible. That is all the comments we have. So thank you guys for leaving those comments. And if you guys want to email me directly with any comments on the show, you can do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. And I'm doing pretty good for my hernia surgery. We're on week two now, or week and a half, I guess, because it was on the 18th. And I'm feeling much better, moving around a little bit more. I've been off work for a while. So I will hopefully be going back to work next weekend after they clear me to go back to work. I have to see the doctor first. But yeah, it was a tough surgery. If you never had hernia surgery before, like I told you last week, they did a robotic surgery where they made three holes in my lower abdominals. And I guess the robot goes in and puts the mesh in. And I could just feel very, very sensitive, very sore in my whole abdominal wall. So I did not expect that. I never talked to anyone before who had robotic surgery with a mesh. So I thought it would be pretty easy, but I was pretty sore and kind of a lot of pain for the first few days. Took at least a week to start feeling better, and it's been about a week and a half, so I'm starting to move around a little bit. Like the swelling has gone down in my waist. I can feel where they put the mesh in. And I've had quite a few people emailing me, asking me to talk to me about the surgery. I just didn't feel up to it yet, so maybe I'll get back to those people later. I just didn't want to talk about it yet. I didn't know how it was turning out with the stomach being so bloated. I didn't even know if it worked, because if you remember, I had the surgery last year where they made an incision, tried to stitch up the hernia, and it didn't work, and it came back. So that's why I had to have the surgery again this year. So anyways, I am now going on week two and be out of the gym for like 6 weeks. So I'm actually going to try a detox for a few weeks, like 3 weeks, starting tomorrow. And I'm only going to eat like four meals a day. Dave Palumbo gave me this detox diet. So it's just very, very lean protein and 40 grams of carbs each meal and 45 grams of protein and four times a day. You just eat four meals a day. That's it. Drink a lot of water, of course. Take supplements to help detoxify your kidney, your liver, and all that stuff. And I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it for 3 weeks. It'll be pretty tough just staying off the cookies for 3 weeks, but I'm going to give it a shot and see how that works. So I'll give you guys an update on that next week. All right. So that's all I got for our opening. So here's our interview with my friend Dan Solomon, where we are going to talk about the 2020 Mr. Olympia coming up next month in Las Vegas. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I have a very special guest this week, Mr. Dan Solomon, who is the president of the Olympia, the Mr. Olympia. Dan, welcome to the show. I appreciate you taking the time to join me, buddy.
John, it's always good to talk to a guy who really knows bodybuilding and also a guy who really knows Florida. And of course, bodybuilding and Florida are the two hot topics right now for a whole bunch of reasons. So it's good to be here.
I'm glad I moved here. Well, Dan, I know you've been making the rounds and you're super busy, so I appreciate you joining me. Tell us a little bit about this whole year, this COVID stuff. I'm sure you started planning the Olympia at the beginning of the year or probably after last year. And you did a fantastic job last year, especially with Sean Roden not being able to show up. That was your first time. You did a fantastic job with it. But take me through this year, like what you went through with COVID thing happening. And then I'm sure it was a roller coaster ride through this whole year.
Yeah, last year sure does seem like a long time ago, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does.
You know, we came off of last year's event. We felt pretty good. We were able to pack the Orleans Arena, and in spite of a whole lot of indications that that might not go that way. So we felt really good about the work of our team and of the fitness industry sort of rallying around the event. Kind of reminded us of, you know, how resilient the bodybuilding world is and how loyal the fans are to the Olympia as an event. So that felt pretty good. And then we came off of that event, and a few short months after, the Olympia, along with Muscle and Fitness, was acquired by Jake Wood.
Right.
And that created a pretty significant shift in a positive way, but nonetheless kind of reshaped how we do business. And our entire structure was changed. We went from being owned by a large corporation, American Media, to suddenly found ourselves in the hands of a whole different type of an ownership. One that I think has really lent positively to the brand, and fans I think will really benefit, as will the athletes, from Jake's leadership, ownership, and guidance. But what that forced us to do is kind of retool the entire model of how we do things. And then just a few weeks after the transaction completed, we learned the word COVID-19.
Mm-hmm.
And that then kind of set a whole nother set of circumstances in place that forced us to have to evaluate every part of the event, specifically when we were going to hold it. As of course, everyone knows, the Olympia is held every year in September. Mm-hmm. And so we had to move the event from September to as late in the year as possible so we could give ourselves as much time to be able to still hold it in the calendar year 2020. We thought that was important because of what it represents for the sport and kind of crowning our champion every year. But we also wanted to give ourselves as much time as possible to have a chance to pull it off, knowing that we would need the extra few months to kind of move beyond COVID. So we moved it from September to December. And in doing so, we were able to take it from the former home at the Orleans Hotel to a beautiful new spot, the Planet Hollywood, right in the center of the Las Vegas Strip.
Right.
And we were real excited about what we were about to produce and present at that property. But then in recent weeks, the script flipped once again when we learned that the state of Nevada and the city of Las Vegas and the hotel itself were met with some really extreme limitations that were actually going to put the event in doubt. And best case scenario, you're going to be able to have a few hundred people attend the event, which, John, I know you've been to the Olympia many times, and you know all too well that a few hundred people is pretty much the same as zero when it comes to the Olympia.
Yeah.
And we have thousands and thousands of commitments. So that became a real difficult pill to swallow. But we also had to monitor and respect the safety protocol as well. We didn't want to be reckless and irresponsible about that. So that's kind of where we are right now, where we decided to go from that property to Central Florida, the Orange County Convention Center, right in the heart of Orlando, minutes from all sorts of vacation attractions and theme parks and all sorts of stuff. And it has turned out to be what we think is going to be a great home for the event. It's going to allow us to put on exactly the kind of Olympia experience that we had hoped to in a smaller way. This isn't going to look and feel like the Olympias that everyone is used to, or 45,000 people flock to a city. It's not going to be like that, of course, this year.
Yeah.
We're not going to have a full-blown expo, so there'll be a lot of differences. But the event itself, we're just real proud that we're able to honor our commitments to our VIPs and ticket holders and the friends and family of the competitors. And of course, John, you know all too well, this year's Olympia is epic. We have one of the best lineups we've had in decades. We have an athlete trying to achieve the all-time record, which is something that we're real excited to see how that plays out. And we just felt like we wanted to make sure those athletes were able to stand on a stage in front of an audience that could really complement the overall experience. So Orlando, here we come. We'll be there in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think it's amazing what you guys pulled off. Just, you know, it was only less than a month ago. It was just amazing how Jake Wood and you and the whole team was able to change venues with such little time. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because when I first called up Jake about this idea, and it was becoming more and more obvious that the situation in Vegas was becoming very dire, I called up Jake, and the first part of the conversation, we focused on the fact that, wow, we're only 5 weeks away from the event, an event that we normally spend 7 months producing.
Right.
How is it possible to pull this off? So we kind of focused on the fact that there's only 5 weeks. Are we crazy to even consider this? And then we kind of shifted to another mode where we said, you know what? True that there's only 5 weeks, but there's still 5 weeks.
You're right.
And 5 weeks, you know, if you have a good team and you have a good focused clarity and you kind of know what you're doing, you can make good use of 5 weeks. And yeah, we kind of realized quickly that there's one of two announcements that we're going to have to make. We're either going to announce to a whole bunch of people that think they're coming to the Olympia that they have to stay home and can't come. That's one announcement. But the other announcement's going to be, you know what, guys? Pardon the inconvenience, but you're going to just have to change your flights and go to another city. And we thought that was a much more desirable conversation to have with the fans, to tell them to go somewhere else as opposed to not go anywhere at all.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you mentioned history too, Dan. And I mean, you're a big sports fan, so I'm sure, you know, you saw that they had the World Series this year. They had the NBA championships. We're going to have a Super Bowl next year. So why, with bodybuilding, why stop the Super Bowl of bodybuilding? Wouldn't it have been terrible to have that blip on the list of all the Mr. Olympias and you have 220, oh, we didn't have it. You know, I mean, that would have been inconceivable, right? In the long run.
We thought about that. You know, these other sports, major sports, had their world championships in their respective league. We felt like it was important for us to have ours. So the thing is, the Olympia is not just another event. It represents a ton to the industry, to the history of the sport, to the commerce of what we do, to sponsors and exhibitors. So we had to figure out a sort of a fine line to be able to do this in a responsible way, but also to be able to honor that continuity and that tradition. And I think we found that sweet spot. And I think everybody who goes is going to see that we're doing it the right way and we're taking cautions, but we're also allowing the event to proceed. And we think we're going to have ourselves a pretty exciting situation, just given all the variables. And it's also kind of a coming together of the industry. Let's face it, this year has been hard.
Yeah.
A lot of people in all aspects of life have had really big challenges, and personally, professionally, financially, in many, many ways. And to be able to provide an opportunity like this, look, not everybody has to go. If you don't feel comfortable going, don't come. Everybody has their own unique risk profiles and their own unique circumstances, and we respect that. We're also doing a big pay-per-view production. We respect those who don't want to attend, who don't feel like it's suitable for them to attend. So we're really trying to create circumstances that sort of fit with everybody's unique situations. And but we're all going to be coming together in December for Olympia weekend.
So tell us a little bit about the event, Dan. It's going to be at the Orlando Convention Center, right? So tell, sort of set it up for us where it's going to be.
It's actually called the Orange County Convention Center, which the key to being able to put on an event right now is space. Square footage is the key. The more open space you have, the more of a pathway you have to provide a prudent, socially responsible model for the event. And it's hard to find open space, but that's what the Orange County Convention Center gives to us. It gives us the opportunity to have the requisite square footage to put on the kind of event that we can have some baseline attendance, I guess you could say. It's a beautiful convention center, one of the nicest convention centers I've ever walked into. It's spectacular. I'm sure a lot of you all by now have seen the images. It's also attached by a little draw, by a little bridge, a little walkway area, to the Hyatt Regency Orlando, which is a real resort style hotel with, you know, waterfalls and rivers in the back by the pool. And it's a beautiful spot, about 5 minutes from SeaWorld and a few minutes from the airport and a few minutes from area theme parks for those people who want to go to the Olympia and then stay on and kind of do a holiday week in Orlando. But either way, it's a great venue for all parts of, for our amateur Olympia, which we're going to be holding. The amateur Olympia that would have been in Vegas is now going to be in Orlando. We're still planning to have our press conference and our Meet the Olympians. So the event is going to go down in much the same way as our events have gone on in the past. The big difference is going to be we're not going to have a big convention hall style expo because we can't do that this year for obvious reasons. But we're having a smaller, we're calling it a fan pavilion that we built, and it's going to have, you know, our merchandising and some select sponsors and exhibitors, and it'll kind of be the central hub or the central artery of the weekend. And that'll be inside the convention center's West Hall. So everything is conveniently, you don't even have to rent a car to come to this event. Everything is just right there. You go from the hotel to the convention center. Everything is in various parts of the convention center. Even if you're a VIP, the banquet is back at the hotel. So everything is neatly tucked together. And I think it's going to be a whole lot easier for fans to attend this year's Olympia than probably any Olympia we've ever had, because it's all kind of right there together.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I looked at the website right before we started this interview, and you know, you've got the room reservations on there. You can make your room reservations right from the website, right?
Yeah, so we have a room block at the Hyatt Regency Orlando, discounted for those who want to come. And if you go to the website, you'll find a link there in the travel section at MrOlympia.com.
Right.
And get room, and tickets will actually go on sale beginning Monday. So it took us a little while to get that put together because we had to kind of revamp our whole seating map.
Sure, yeah.
And everything worked out and uploaded. So we're about a day or so away from going live with that. So yeah, there's going to be a very limited number of tickets though, because we don't have the capacity like we normally would. If I'm not mistaken, some, you know, the number of tickets that are going to be available to the general public after we've already filled our VIP obligations and our sponsor commitments and the other things that we have to do, not a significant number. So if you are interested in going, when you do see the announcement that the tickets are on sale, don't wait, because they might sell out in a day or two, because there's not a significant number of tickets. So if you want to kind of witness this thing firsthand and be among the few that are in the building to actually see it, don't just assume that the tickets are going to last long, because they probably won't.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the pay-per-view, Dan. How's that going to work? Because I know you guys are putting a lot into that this year for those that don't want to risk coming out, you know, because of the COVID thing.
Yeah. So Jake really took a big interest in the pay-per-view, and that was really great for all of us. And I think the fans will enjoy it. So there's a few different ways you can experience the pay-per-view. One is what we call the premium package, which is the package that allows you to watch not only the Friday and Saturday evening finals, the same thing that you used to be able to see on a webcast.
Right.
But we're also going to carry that into the morning prejudging. So if you purchase that package for $49.95, you'll be able to do that and watch those events live from anywhere in the world, from most places in the world that, you know, are compliant with being able to watch U.S. streaming videos.
Right.
Beyond that, we have an amateur Olympia package, which is separate for those who want to just experience the amateur Olympia. Maybe you have a friend or a family member who's competing in that show. That event has turned out to be a pretty great event. It's open to all NPC members, and it's a pro qualifier. So it's a really exciting event, and for athletes to get a chance to compete as part of the whole Olympia experience. So we'll have a separate package for that. And then we're doing something also, which is kind of cool. It's called an Olympia. It's called the Fan Channel, which costs nothing. And this channel is what we're going to do, and we're going to use that to stream the live coverage of the press conference of the Meet the Olympians. We're even going to have live coverage of our fan pavilion and the things that are going on around there. So that's another kind of a great way to sort of get a taste of what's going on around the Olympia. And once again, that's never been done before. So the pay-per-view is a pretty big commitment this year, and I think you'll see improvements in overall quality.
Yeah, and I saw Sean Ray on MD the other day, and he made a good point. He was like, with the cost of the pay-per-view, if you were going to Vegas or even to Orlando or whatever, but let's say it was in Vegas, if you were going there and you got off the plane and you bought a couple snacks and you took the Uber to the hotel, that's $60 right there. So you can watch the whole pay-per-view this whole Olympia weekend just from a really minimal cost.
Yeah, you know, the other part about it is it's funny because the fact that Jake has made a commitment to continue forward with the event and also give away prize money that's larger than any bodybuilding or fitness event that's ever been held. And I mean that sincerely. We're giving away over $1.5 million this year. That's more money than has ever been given at a bodybuilding or fitness contest in the history of the world.
Wow. Amazing.
And that's happening in a year where there's significantly less opportunity to sell tickets and sponsorship, exhibitors. Yet I mentioned because I know there will be people who have gotten used to watching the webcast for free, but the pay-per-view is what's enabling on some level us to be able to put on the event.
Mm-hmm.
It's allowing the property that we want to be able to award. So it's not just something that, you know, we decided one day to just do just to for a money grab. It's not what that is at all. The pay-per-view is really an opportunity to create financial viability that allows the event to go on. As many events have been canceled, many big events have been canceled, as many businesses have closed, as lots of challenges have been met around the world, this event is carrying forward.
Yeah.
And without any real, you know, decline in overall experience or production value, we're going forward with it. And we feel like putting on a pay-per-view kind of gives, you know, our new ownership and our team the opportunity to sort of execute this thing with some level of financial responsibility. And we're hoping everybody kind of uses that as an opportunity to support the sport, support the event. And that's what the pay-per-view represents, in addition to obviously heightened viewer experience, which is something that we're trying to give as much value as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think if you're a fan of the sport, yeah, you really have to support it, and just at least buy the pay-per-view if you're not going to make it out there, you know.
For sure. And like you said, $49.95. I mean, you're right. That's a cab ride from the airport to the exactly. To the hotel. I think Sean probably nailed it perfectly. So it's a good value for sure.
Hey Dan, when was your first Mr. Olympia? What was the first one you ever saw?
The first one I attended was 1998. It was Ronnie's first one. Dorian showed up and announced his retirement on that stage. Ronnie competed, and Flex Wheeler was supposed to win the contest, if you remember.
Yeah.
And Ronnie beat him, and you know, Nasser El Sambadi and Chris Cormier and Sean Ray and Kevin. It was a really great sort of, you know, late 90s event. And I remember I kind of attended that show without any real plans to. I happened to be in New York, and that was the last time it was held somewhere other than Vegas, of course, until this year. But a real unexpected sense of me. You know, I'm there in the building, and I've always been a casual fan of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
I attended that night, and I watched it all play out, and it was just really
it's one of the most exciting Olympias ever. So what a first one to start with.
Right. So maybe that's why I was hooked. But I remember just watching the energy in the building and the way the fans responded. And also there was connections on stage between the athletes, and it was rivalries, and it was a different time in the sport. And I left there thinking to myself, I didn't know how I wanted to be a part of it. I just knew there was something. And I think we all have that moment. You certainly have that moment. We've all had that moment where you see something and you touch something and you experience something and you're there and you say, I don't really know how, but I know that I want this in my life. And so one thing led to the next. And here we are more than 20 years later doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw you when you talked to Ron Harris the other day, you were asking him his predictions. Do you have any predictions? Can you give out predictions on who you think's going to
win? I can't. I can't do that. But I always tell all you media guys, man, don't ever be shy about giving out predictions, because that's what you're supposed to do. That's what the fans count on you to do. Don't ever worry about losing a friend over a prediction, because I always say, if somebody decides to quote unquote unfriend you because you did not predict them to win, then you do not need that person in your life, because everybody has a job to do. And your job is to give predictions, and the athlete's job is to prepare for the contest. So no, I obviously, in my position, and it's funny, I don't really think about it too much. I just kind of, you know, revel in the opportunity to showcase these athletes and to try to do what we can to make the moment mean as much as possible. Look, I don't think anybody is ignorant to the fact that Phil Heath, at his best, is one of the greatest bodybuilders of all time. And I think it's a funny part. I won't give a prediction, but I'll just say this. I think it's funny when people say the words, I predict that if so-and-so is at his best. Well, that to me is silly, because obviously if so-and-so is at his best, it's almost like saying, well, I predict the Raiders are going to win tomorrow's NFL game if they play the best game they've ever played. Like, that doesn't even make sense to say. What you should say is, I believe he's going to be at his best. Or I don't believe he's going to be at his best. But to say the words, if so-and-so is at best, he's going to be hard to beat, that to me is the most uncourageous prediction you can make. Right? Because we all know that if someone's – we all know if Phil is at his best, nobody's beating that, right? We know that. And similarly, we know that if Phil's not at his best, it opens the door for a number of guys to walk through it, and including the reigning champion, Brandon Curry, to keep his title. So anybody out there who's a prediction business, ever say the words, I think if someone was at their best, they're going to win, because that is not exactly a bold or courageous prediction.
Right. Well, I'll predict who I think is going to win. I think the 212, I think George is going to win.
I think
he looks phenomenal. You know, he looked amazing at that Tampa Pro. I was there, and I saw him there.
And, And isn't he kind of sort of a half hometown guy for you? I know I see him in your neighborhood sometimes when I'm out there. I think I was I in the gym over at Ben's place, and I ran into him over at Pekulski's MI-40.
I know a lot of the guys went to Ben's place when they were in town. Yeah,
I mean, maybe that was it. But yeah, he's a tremendous bodybuilder. Of course, Derek's also another local guy. Lunsford,
Derek, and amazing physique,
really good, tremendous potential. And then Kamal's got it going on. He's a tremendous bodybuilder, great guy too. So
yeah,
the division's looking pretty good for sure in that 212.
Yeah, classic. I'm going with Breon. I think he's going to take it back. I think he's going to take it away from Bumstead.
Yeah, both of those guys are just unbelievable.
That's going to be an exciting contest.
Yeah, that division is really exciting. Those physiques have just gotten to a place where it's just otherworldly physiques these guys have. And
it's cool. They got a little rivalry too. That's kind of neat.
Yeah, that seems to be the one division where the athletes aren't afraid to come out and kind of nip at each other a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Bodybuilding, on the bodybuilding side, people have gotten really, you know, laid back and very friendly to each other. Nobody wants to dip and fire up any shots. And then, of course, the bikini, the girls are all very classy to each other, at least
their
faces. But the overall issue on the men's physique side, it's definitely fun to watch these guys kind of have a little bit of fun with it.
Yeah. Nothing against the current champ, Bumstead, but I just think Breon is – and he's really been playing the social media good. He's putting new pictures up on YouTube. It seems like this guy's been in hard training from January to get this title back. So he's hungry. He's got a great physique. So that's exciting to see.
It's funny because coming into last year, I think we all thought Breon was like
– Yeah. Oh yeah, he looked amazing in the social media photos, right?
Yeah, but just when you just look at his overall proportions and you look at him and you're like, who's going to beat that guy? And then Bumstead came in there and took it, to his credit. So, it just goes to show just kind of how good these guys are getting.
Yeah. The Olympia, I'm going with Brandon. I think he's going to repeat. You know, I don't think – it's not happened too much where a guy wins and then doesn't win. But I know he's going to be facing a big challenge with Phil Heath. But we'll see what Phil's stomach looks like. I think Brandon's hungry. I think he wants that title. And I think he's going to make significant improvements. And I think he's going to do it. I think he's going to surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'll just say this. Regardless of how this goes, Brandon has been a model champion.
Yeah.
He has handled his business with complete class. He and his wife, Brandy, and their kids, just all around good people. And I actually wish for their sake they had a more normal year to be a reigning champion, because those 12 months to be the reigning Olympia champion can be very valuable in someone's life.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Brandon won it in a year where he was very limited in what he could do as a representative of the title, just given the limitations and the quarantine and all that. So, yeah, I definitely admire Brandon tremendously, and he's a really just a – good guy. He's a hard worker. He's over there in Kuwait. You can be sure he does not want to be known as a one-time champ. He really is committed to showing everybody that what they saw last year does not represent the best of him. He's seen people. He's read the post. He's seen all the comments. People have suggested that he's one of the lesser Olympia champions, and he's seen all that stuff. So you can be sure that Brandon has plenty of fuel, as does Phil, as does William Bonac, who almost won the title last year. As does Big Ramy or Hadi Chupan, which, to be honest with you, if I had a scorecard last year, Hadi Chupan would have gotten some first place votes. That guy was really, really good.
So
there's a lot there. And then what can't be lost in all of this is the opportunity to see Dexter Jackson compete for the final time. Another great Florida connection. So maybe on some level, having the event in Florida is almost poetic, because it definitely there's a lot of storylines in the show that kind of connect back to the state of Florida. So Dexter's final Olympia, that's going to be pretty special for a lot of us who have followed his career.
Yeah, that is. And I did a little history, Dan, because this is bodybuilding history. So I looked back, and we were talking about how we got three Mr. Olympias coming back. Of course, we got Brandon coming back, Dexter, former Mr. Olympia from 2008, and then we got Phil Heath coming back. The only time I think that's ever happened before was in 1984 when Lee Haney won the first time, and you had Sergio Oliva coming back to the Olympia. You had Chris Dickerson in that show, and you had Samir Banute. I think that's the only time we had three former Mr. Olympias in the country.
So here's the thing. You are by far the top historian that I deal with at this point. So I'm not gonna doubt you. However, I posed this question to Bob Chick a few months back when this something came together. And he called me, and I think he said there was two times that it happened.
All right.
I don't remember what the other one was, but he said that there was two instances where three men who had won the title had competed on the same stage that same year. I don't remember what the other one was, but you got to call Bob in for them.
Because
he said there was another time when it happened. But, you know, as long as we're connecting the dots on history, the last time an Olympia was held in Orlando, of course, was 1991. And that was the year Leaney won his eighth Santa Trophy. So, again, another sort of ironic connection point where now we're back in Orlando 19 years later, and we have Phil Heath going for his eighth Santa Trophy. So plenty of really compelling storyline that we'll be following this year.
Oh, yeah. It's gonna be I'll ask Bob about that. I can't. Maybe I missed one that was in the later years. I remember more the older years than the later years, you know, for some reason.
Yeah. I mean, look, maybe Bob misread it. I just remembered him saying that it happened twice because I wasn't sure if it had ever happened, and then he reminded me that it had happened twice. So I know that if we've been able to get if it had turned out Sean Roden at the beginning of this year, which, you know, we were kind of all hoping that might happen, that would have taken us to four this year. And four has never happened.
No.
So that's something that we were kind of hoping would happen. And, you know, I think we're doing okay either way.
Yeah, I think we've had Phil Heath, Jay, and Dexter all on stage at the same time. But if I'm not mistaken, I'm not sure if Phil was the winner. Maybe he was. I'm not sure. I don't think it was Mr. Olympia.
So the year after Phil took Jay's title, Jay came back to try to win it back, right?
Okay.
So that would have been that. Maybe that was the other time.
That was probably the year then. Yeah.
That's the other time. Yeah, because Dexter, of course, was in that show because he's in every Olympia. So Dexter, Phil, and Jay would have been the three then. So there's your second one. So I think we just solved it.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, thank you, Dan, for joining me on the show. I know you're super busy, and I apologize for keep bugging you to come on here. But I know you're doing a great job getting the word out about the Mr. Olympia, and I'm so happy that you're the president and you're running things now. I think it's much improved, in my opinion. So I really appreciate all you do and getting it out to the media. I think it's fantastic how you're doing all this and getting the information out there.
Well, don't ever apologize to me for reaching out, because you're one of the more authentic guys out there. You do this for all the right reasons. It is a pure love that you have. And everybody knows that about you. Whenever we talk about the real treasures out there that cover the sport the right way and appreciate the past and understand the history, you're that guy right now. You're sort of carrying that flag. And I know that when I think about it, of course, we all think about Peter McGuff, who's kind of home dealing with a whole bunch of things right now. And we're always thinking about Peter and hoping he gets strong and ready to kind of start doing some of this stuff again. But what you do is very important, and we're all very grateful for it. So thanks for having me. MrOlympia.com has all the information. We'll have the tickets stuff pretty soon. You guys can always hit me up on Instagram or any one of those other things. Thanks so much for having me here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. And I look forward to being at the show and look forward to seeing you there.
Thanks, Sean. Be good, bud.
All right, buddy. Take care. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to my friend Dan Solomon for taking the time to come on and give the interview, because I know Dan is very, very busy. As I mentioned in the interview, I had to keep bugging him to do the interview, but you can imagine with making all those changes they had to make in only a 4-week time period or 5-week time period, it was probably unbelievable, but they are pulling it off. So Dan is the right man for the job, and I'm glad that he is running the Mr. Olympia. And I really look forward to going out there next month to seeing another Mr. Olympia contest. It should be great. So I want to thank Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And as always, I want to thank our generous sponsors who are sponsoring the show on Patreon every month. I really appreciate you guys. And without further ado, I'm going to read a little bit of the book Muscle Wars. And this is a fantastic book written by Rick Wayne. And I want to read about that era of 1968, which I kind of just covered at the video I just did on YouTube on my bodybuilding history segment, where I talked about the 1968 Mr. Olympia. All right, it says, by his own account, Oliva was born in Cuba in 1941 on the 4th of July. At age 12, he was working with his father in the cane fields of Huambaco. He was barely 16 when his father suggested he should enlist in dictator Fulgencio Batista's army.
Cuban law dictated that Army recruits be at least 18, but with Fidel Castro's revolutionaries baying at his heels, Batista could hardly afford to be choosy. Sergio was tall for his age. His physique was lean and wiry, and he had the broad shoulders of his robust father. He looked strong enough to carry a gun. In the absence of a birth certificate, the recruiting officer took the senior Oliva's word that his son was old enough to fight the good fight against communism. The young man took to army life. The pay was good, as was the food. Before long, Sergio had decided to become a career soldier, but he hadn't counted on Castro's takeover of the country. Suddenly, Sergio's paradise was a living hell. His career choice was nullified. The ex-soldier took to idling away his hours at the beach. All day long, he dreamed of fleeing the island and joining relatives in nearby Miami. Easier dream than done. Then one day, a fellow sun worshiper invited Sergio to his local weightlifting club. As they say, the rest is history. Barely 6 months after first touching a barbell, Sergio was doing clean and jerks with over 400 pounds. Small wonder that he was picked to represent Cuba at the 1961 Pan American Games in Kingstown, Jamaica. A few hours before his event in Kingston, Sergio approached one of the guards assigned by Castro to watch over his athletes. Sergio complained of nervousness, said he felt tense. He wanted to take a stroll to help him relax. It would be nice to take a look at the Cuban embassy, he suggested to the guard. The sight would inspire him, fire up his revolutionary spirit, strengthen his determination to excel for Fidel. Impressed, the guard accompanied Sergio on his walk. They talked about his wonderful changes that Castro had brought about at home. And all the while, the star weightlifter was thinking, sucker. By the time Sergio returned to camp, Cuba's fencers were already warming up. Thanking his guard, the weightlifter returned to his quarters, but not for long. While the guards were distracted, Sergio sneaked out and was soon running for his life. He ran at top speed until he was safely inside the American consulate, a few yards from his island's nation's embassy. Breathless, he demanded political asylum. 65 other Cubans followed him a few seconds later, including Castro's entire weightlifting team. For a full year afterward, the Cuban emigre made his living as a TV repairman in Miami, Florida. In 1963, he moved to Chicago, where he took a job at a steel mill. He joined the Duncan YMCA, famous for its weightlifters and bodybuilders, and he was soon following 10-hour factory shifts with gym sessions that often lasted 3 hours. Before long, the bodybuilding grapevine was abuzz with gossip about this crazy powerhouse who lifted more weight than the local Olympic champs and whose physique was equal to, if not beyond, that of the reigning Mr. Universe. And yet the first time Sergio Oliva competed in the relatively minor Mr. Chicago contest, he was found unworthy of the title. It was no consolation to have an avuncular AAU official explain that he'd lost the contest because he didn't speak English like a born American. He was luckier in 1964. He took the Mr. Chicago, but luck deserted him at the Mr. America. In 1965, he lost to a bloated Jerry Daniels. The following year, it was Bob Guida's turn to play David at the Cuban's Goliath. At that point, as we've already noted, Sergio joined the IFBB, and then he won both the 66 Mr. World and the 66 Mr. Universe with no sweat. Small wonder that he could hardly wait to enter the 67 Mr. Olympia, scheduled for 3 months after the Montreal World's Fair. He harbored no bitterness against the AAU. Indeed, he carried it on as if the joke were on the judges who had denied him the Mr. America title. Men who, by Sergio's account, often apologized for playing by Bob Hoffman's rules. Hoffman, Sergio told me, had once advised him to join the U.S. weightlifting team and quit wasting energy on the Mr. America ambitions that would never be realized. That, of course, only fueled the Cuban's resolve to be the greatest bodybuilder of all time, not just in the eyes of the fans, but also officially. If on stage his physique boggled the mind, in street clothes, Sergio was dazzling. He was a walking contradiction to the widely held belief that after the flood, God had decreed that the children of Ham were never to be equals of their white counterparts. Massive gold bracelets and chains rattled from his wrist and neck. The short sleeves of his custom-built shirts were split from the bottom of his deltoids down to his elbows, as if to allow his enormous triceps breathing space. His waist measured all of 29 inches, precisely the circumference of his thighs, which threatened the soft fabric of his high-waisted pants every time Sergio sat down. His shoulders seemed a good 6 inches wider than the largest reclining chair. His calves measured close to 20 inches. As in previous years, the 1967 Miss Americana, Mr. America, Mr. World, Mr. Olympia show was staged at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. Sure enough, it was a night full of thrills. for the Pack Theater as well as for the Contenders. Two special moments will forever remain with me. During the first, I stood on stage with the finalists from the various events, nervous as a virgin in a Mexican bordello, sharing dreams with Frank Zane. We'd already been declared winners of our respective classes. As we waited for the overall winners to be announced, Frank whispered to me, "Hey, Rick, wouldn't it be nice if Christine won the Americana, you the world, and I the America?" Christine was soon to be Mrs. Zane. Frank got two of his wishes. Alas, the 1967 Mr. America title went to Californian Don Howarth. The second most memorable moment had nothing to do with sentiment. What it had to do was with shock, which was precisely what I felt upon seeing Sergio Oliva standing between Harold Poole and Chuck Sipes during a final backstage comparison. In Montreal 3 months before, the Cuban had strained the bodybuilding imagination. Now he threatened my mental circuitry. Since Montreal, he gained 5 pounds of rock-hard muscle, yet that amazing Oliva waist remained as tight as ever. It really didn't matter that Poole was at his very best or that Sipes, who'd already won every physique title save one and was generally considered the world's strongest bodybuilder, had exceeded all expectations. Next to Oliva, Poole and Sipes were merely extraordinary. One wondered why the judges had insisted on the backstage comparison. A blind man could tell Oliva was hors cours, that he inhibited a realm beyond the aspirations of those who thought to be his peers. After he accepted an engraved silver platter and 10 crisp $100 bills from Joe Weider, Sergio rammed an enriched right fist overhead and, like some over-muscled Tarzan, let out a victory roar. "Sock it to me, baby. Sock it to me." He had the best possible revenge for the AAU's injustice to his race. He'd landed bodybuilding with a new king, who was black. In the unbridled jubilation that greeted Oliva's coronation, it is doubtful that any of the congregated 2,000 fans gave a thought to Larry Scott. 1 week later in London, it was Arnold Schwarzenegger's turn to occupy the bodybuilding limelight. His Mr. Universe victory had to be the most predictable in the history of NABBA. No more than a handful of the British fans had any doubt that Arnold could have wiped out Bill Pearl, who competed in the pro category and registered his third NABBA victory. When I asked Pearl why he continued to compete in London and avoided the by far more prestigious Mr. Olympia, he said, "I couldn't get a fair shake from Weider's judges." It seems Pearl and Weider were not the best of friends. On the other hand, Joe Weider was especially keen on acquiring the new muscle sensation, Arnold Schwarzenegger. In New York, Weider and I had discussed Arnold at length. I had sold the publisher the first Schwarzenegger story to appear in Muscle Builder. On my return to London, I delivered to Lud Schusterich a letter from Weider instructing his European representative to invite the Austrian to compete in the 1968 IFBB Mr. Universe to be held at Miami Beach. All expenses would be paid by Weider. After the contest, which Arnold was expected to win with no trouble whatsoever, the new IFBB champ would be invited to stay on in the United States for a full year. In return for endorsing Weider's vitamins, equipment, and training courses, he would receive a car, a furnished Santa Monica apartment, and a weekly allowance. Arrangements would be made for him to work out at Gold's near Venice Beach, acknowledged as the world's best gym. There he would have as his training partners Dave Draper and other famous stallions of Weider's West Coast stable. Arnold had been preparing himself for life in America ever since he was 12. Somehow he'd known even then that this was where his destiny lay. When he was 18, he'd met an itinerant American photographer in Germany who had convinced him that to get to heaven, a man didn't have to die. He simply had to hie himself to Southern California, where there were six-lane highways, year-round sunshiny days, sandy beaches, and the forever tan bodies of ever-eager, luscious women. And yet, when Schusterich first presented Arnold with the opportunity of his life, the Austrian was reluctant to accept. He'd made some money on the European muscle circuit, enough to buy shares in a thriving Munich gym. But he was by no means rich. Certainly, he was in no position to turn down a good thing like Weider's offer. But NABBA friends had convinced him that Weider's propositions nearly always turned out to have hollow centers. Arnold worried that if he took a chance on Weider and things proved unsatisfactory in America, he might not be able to pick up where he left off in Europe. He told Schusterich he'd give him his proposal serious consideration while preparing for the 1968 NABBA Pro Universe. In Brooklyn that year, even as Frank Zane was being declared Mr. America, the name on everyone's lips was Schwarzenegger. But clearly, the Austrian did not consider himself quite ready for the Olympia. Sergio showed up at the Academy of Music ready to take on the world, but no one challenged him. Well, at least not to compare physiques. There was the man in the dark suit with a waist that must have measured nearly 40 inches, who stood barely 5'6" in his elevated shoes, whose shoulders owed a lot to the discreet Brooklyn tailor named Mo. That is to say, there was Dan Lurie. Lurie had 3 times been voted America's most muscular man, although never in Oliva's lifetime. Once he had been a successful circus strongman. As if by 1968 he was but a pudgy apology for his former self, his thirst for the limelight had not diminished. He had his own bodybuilding magazine, Muscle Training Illustrated, which everyone referred to as MTI. He had his own barbell and food manufacturing company, and he ran his own contest. In the business of bodybuilding, Lurie was, by his own measure, second only to his one-time partner, Joe Eater. After accepting his prize money at the 1968 Olympia, Oliva asked for the microphone. For a dizzy moment, the audience was transported back to 1966, when Larry Scott had announced his retirement precisely when he was at his most popular. Was Oliva going the way of Scott? With Joe Weider looking on, Sergio said, "I want to thank the IFBB for all the success I've had since 1966. I want to say also that I owe my muscles to Weider's supplements. They're the best." "You're a damn liar." All eyes turned toward the source of the bold put down, the rotund ex-circus performer in the dark suit, who was vigorously waving the most recent issue of MTI, featuring Oliva on both covers. "Come up here and say that," blurted the Weider stalwart, eyes bulging. The audience offered Lurie every encouragement to commit suicide. "Go on, Dan," they shouted. "Get up there and tell us about it." Lurie scrambled up to the stage, made his way to the mic. He told the audience that Oliva had used his company's weight gain supplement while preparing for his first Olympia defense, and that Oliva had been paid $1,000 for his endorsement of that Lurie product. Lurie held up his magazine, back cover to the audience. "Here's the proof," he said. "Sergio used my weight gain, and here's the picture to prove it." Oliva spoke up in his own defense. He claimed Lurie had taken unfair advantage of his difficulty with English. He was, after all, Cuban. He had posed for the picture, yes, that was true, but he'd been deceived. Lurie's photographer had led him to believe that he was working for Weider. Sergio said he would never have endorsed someone else's product, not when he was under exclusive contact to Joe Weider. Accusing forefinger pointed at Lurie, the Cuban roared, "I no speak English. You con me, you crook." He said he learned from bitter experience that in all the world of bodybuilding, one man alone was trustworthy, Joe Weider, who throughout the heated exchange smiled his Mona Lisa smile from the sidelines while his feisty photographer, Jimmy Caruso, recorded the unscheduled event for posterity. If the 1968 Olympia served America's muscle maniacs more than they paid for, that year's Pro Universe in London provided less excitement for supporters of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Obsessed with being the world's biggest body man, Arnold had lost his head and gained far more than was good for his physique. He showed up in London looking like a ton of lard. Only a miracle saved him from defeat by local boy Johnny Citrone. 8 days after he collected his second NABBA award, Arnold fouled his stomach down to Miami Beach Auditorium to compete with the leading American champions in the IFBB Mr. Universe pageant. It never entered the Austrian's mind that the event would be anything but an easily digested vorspeise to be savored before pitching into the main course, bodybuilding's cock of the walk, Sergio Oliva. A packed house welcomed Arnold's first appearance on U.S. soil. He seemed damn sure of himself, full of Aryan contempt. You could tell by his stage manner, his pigeon-toed strut, the way he carried his enormous chest, that he privately held himself above Roy Callender, Don Peters, Eddie Giuliani, and the other Mr. Universe contenders. He weighed close to 250 pounds, and never mind that he was as smooth as a baby's behind, he fully expected to overwhelm the competition with his great bulk. But as the contest heated up, the steel of Arnold's metal melted. He lost his grip on his self-confidence and finally succumbed to the frustrating, relentless superiority of that year's Mr. America, Frank Zane, who was some 70 pounds lighter than Arnold, but displayed deep cuts, ridges, and aesthetic curves all over his body. Zane taught Arnold an important lesson. Mass does not necessarily spell class. We can but speculate on the thoughts that engaged the businessman's mind of Joe Weider as he witnessed the rapid descent of the punctured Schwarzenegger balloon. Weider had not counted on defeat for his latest acquisition. However, at some time during the Mr. Universe competition, it must have occurred to him that victory could render Arnold intolerable. Had he demolished the best America had to offer on his very first U.S. outing, would Arnold be willing to take lessons from their trainer? Weider may also have considered the possibility that when it came to signing on the dotted line, a defeated Arnold would be less demanding than an Arnold triumphant. Frank Zane may have rattled the bones of Schwarzenegger's self-confidence, but the newly crowned Mr. Universe was nothing compared to the night's closing act. Reg Park had spoken of him as if he were just another pebble for Arnold to hop over on his way to the moon. And naive pup that he was, the Austrian had lapped up Park's pack. Well, he was about to discover that it might be no big thing to speak of pulling a tiger's teeth in its absence, but it's an altogether different proposition when the beast is snarling at your throat. Misty-eyed and dejected after his defeat, Arnold stood alone in the wings as a verbose, fawning MC introduced the night's guest headliner. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the one and only unchallenged king of bodybuilding, Sergio Oliva. With an hysterical Miami Beach audience threatening the roof of the auditorium, Arnold's mind raced back to his first meeting with Reg Park, marveling at the unrivaled stupidity of the man for daring to suggest Sergio Oliva was vincible. Obviously, Park had never set eyes on the incredible figure now standing motionless on the podium, hands on hips, wallowing in the unbridled adulation of some 3,000 sunstroke muscle devotees. By the look on Oliva's face, you'd have thought the Cuban had never heard of such entities as Bill Pearl, Larry Scott, Reg Park, John Grimmick, or Steve Reeves. After all, only days earlier, a riotous New York crowd had celebrated his installation as undisputed king of his world. Every presumptuous heir had abruptly abandoned his claim to the crown upon the arrival of Sergio Oliva. There was nothing professional about his stage routine. He seemed to crash land in every pose, but the audience loved him. An ebony Hercules is what he brought to mind. Only this Hercules had the waist and hips of the leanest limbo dancer, with abdominal tessellations that reminded one of the finest brickwork. His presentation was unique. After a series of face-front physique fantastiques, the 5'11" Oliva wheeled around on the balls of his bare feet so that his immense back faced the audience, slowly drew back one leg, tensed the calf muscle so that it separated like the segments of a peeled orange, and then wham, rammed his enormous arms overhead. Huge slabs of contracted meat stood out from his shoulders, neck, and the back of his 29-inch thighs. He held the pose long enough to take his votaries through the sweet agonies of orgasm, and then, swear to God, suddenly stuck out his tight, round, muscular ass and swished it right and left four times, like some butt-fluttering queen in an off-Broadway den of inequity. It was an act so pagan as to remind Arnold of the brassiest whores of Munich's red light district. The fans gobbled all that Oliva offered and begged for more. As Arnold took in Sergio's performance, Park once again came to mind. There was nothing mysterious about success, the transplanted Englishman had assured his guest over Christmas dinner in Johannesburg. It was simply what a man got for being courageous enough to do whatever was necessary to achieve his ambitions. Failure was the price one paid for being too feeble to make the sacrifices demanded for success. Years after his Miami Beach comeuppance, Arnold told me, "When the opportunity came for me to go to America, it didn't matter that I was not in the best shape of my life and that I barely escaped being beaten for the Mr. Universe title in London. I grabbed the ticket Joe Weider sent me and I headed for Miami Beach. And with him, he carried the mental image. Arnold Schwarzenegger, world's greatest bodybuilder." All right. So that's a little excerpt from Rick Wayne's book, Muscle Wars. Again, a fantastic book. If you haven't read it, try to get a copy of it. If you have never heard of it or never read it, it's really, really awesome. All right. That's it for the show this week. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.